Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Chuck Houston, 96 years old, of Fresno, California. A decorated Navy fighter pilot in World War II with VF-14 flying off the aircraft carrier USS Wasp in the Pacific. Later on, he would design architectural projects, manufacture ceramics and building materials, and of course, pump out piece after sterling piece of sculpture. His finest masterpiece, however, may just be the book Flying with Iron Angels, about all those courageous men flying off the Wasp. The last page of that book is the program from a memorial service aboard the Wasp in November 1944. From Chuck's fighter squadron alone are 17 fighter pilots who never got to come home. Many of them lost at sea, their remains never recovered. Chuck, you were a 21-year-old kid dealing with the loss of your friends, and a couple of times it was pilots that you roomed with. You were the one who had to gather up their belongings. How did you handle all that emotional trauma?
I think mainly you just try to bottle it up because it's happening over and over. You really don't get all emotional about it. You just have to close the door and bottle it up.
Is that something that developed over time? That became easier for you to deal with over time when it happened again and again?
It was always painful. You do get used to it, but it was always painful losing a friend.
And I always try to imagine what it would be like if I were in your shoes. First of all, I can't imagine being in those shoes. But is there a moment when something like that happens where you feel or hear yourself saying, that could have been me? Or what if it's me next time? Did you allow yourself to have those thoughts, or did you just tune them completely out?
It was always there. You always knew from day to day and flight to flight it could end any time. So it was exciting, but you lived with it. It was something that was happening every day, and you never knew when the bad time was going to hit you.
And those missions, were they long periods of getting ready, being on alert, and then an intense moment of combat? Were they pretty steady throughout, where you had to be up the whole time? If you think back on a mission from takeoff to landing and the ebb and flow of that, how would you try to help us understand what that feels like from the beginning to the end?
Well, of course, there's the excitement of just the takeoff and joining up in formation. And then from then on, it's just routine formation flying until you get to the target. And then there's the excitement of the diving and gunshots coming up at you from below and any enemy planes that happen to be around. So it changed from time to time, from boredom, monotony, to excitement.
What was the most exciting part of it for you, where you'd feel the adrenaline pumping the most?
Well, of course, nothing was much more exciting than all those big guns shooting up at you. That's quite exciting. But then you do get quick bursts of excitement with an enemy plane coming in, firing at you. So it changed from quick shots of emotion to steady drum beats of fire coming up at you.
Well, I guess another relevant question, too, and I do want to read some more of your specific accounts that thankfully you've preserved for all of us in this outstanding book, Flying with Iron Angels. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to that book and order it online. Was there anything in your training? You spent plenty of time in training in a lot of different planes getting ready to fly the Hellcat, but was there any instruction or advice or caution or warning that you look back on and you say, that was actually really helpful to what I experienced in the air? Maybe it even saved my life?
I can't think of any one thing, but there were many, many endless things. All the information we got along the way and training, it all built up. No single piece.
Well, I do know of a story in your book. It wasn't in training, but in combat. But you talk about a valuable lesson you learned. It was September 21st, 1944, the same day your roommate, Al Lorraine, was killed in action. You write about what you thought had happened that day over Manila Bay, and then what you learned through writing the book that completed that picture. You cite after-action reports from different squadrons aboard your ship. And then you say, as all the readers hang on your every word, this is what really happened. As each of us rolled into our dives from 10,000 feet, our fighters led the way, strafing the guns firing up at us from the ships below. Behind the first fighters in the long string of diving planes, I was out to the left side of a dive bomber, with my trigger finger putting out six lines of tracer bullets at the ship below in my gun sight. So let me pause in that narrative there and ask you, what does that feel like when you start your dive and you're going down, down, down with guns a-blazing and the other stuff is flying back up at you? Most of us will never experience that in our lives. So can you help us understand what those few seconds feel like in the cockpit?
It's pretty hard to put it into words because there's so much emotion involved. The excitement of shooting at someone and, of course, the excitement of being shot at. It's hard to put into words.
I think a lot of people would be closing their eyes and clenching every muscle in their body. How about you?
No, you're busy. All of your muscles are very busy, pushing your feet on the rudder pedals and your hands on the stick and your other left hand on the throttle. Your feet and your hands are very busy.
And how do you know when to pull up?
You see what's happening. You see the water coming up at you. You know you've got to pull up. All those things just kind of happen automatically.
Well, let's continue with your story here, as you so adeptly wrote. Suddenly, we were halfway down to the water. A stream of tracer bullets came from my right side, passing between me and the SB-2C, and then a Tony flew between us, crossing close in front of me and almost into my stream of bullets. I kept my trigger finger pressed down while pulling back on the stick to raise my fire just a little bit higher, and the Tony would pass right through my bullets, I hoped. Unfortunately, by that time, I had continued firing my guns too long without a pause, and I was going to find out soon that I had burned out all six gun barrels. I pulled after the Tony, and as he came out of his dive, I was behind him along with another F-6F. As we reached the edge of Manila Bay at Bataan Peninsula, I had gained on the Tony enough to shoot again, but just as I fired, he pulled into a very tight turn at the perfect time to give me a hard deflection shot. It was then that I saw my line of bullets corkscrewing and tumbling wildly, and I knew my guns were gone. So, for someone who's never been a fighter pilot, they might not understand what we're talking about here, but restraint is a pretty important skill for a fighter pilot to have, isn't it, with regard to the guns and how to manage them correctly?
Well, yes, you don't want to overdo it and ruin your guns. So you had to fire and hold back and not overdo it.
So in this case, you had overdone it, and now you're firing the guns again, and you really have no control of where the bullets are going. Am I getting that right?
That's right. The barrels are melted, curved, and curled up, and they're just tumbling out of the barrels. They're not doing any good anymore.
So you continue. The story isn't done. Right then, I should have given up the whole thing and gone back to protect our bombers. But I was so mad at this guy for busting through our formation, I wasn't thinking clearly and was just determined to get him. We straightened out again, heading north along the shoreline of Bataan Peninsula. I pulled closer and fired my guns higher above him, hoping some of my tumbling bullets would drop onto him and do some damage. But each time, just as I started shooting, he pulled another hard turn to counter me. This guy was an excellent pilot, and he repeated this maneuver about four times as we raced north along the coast, getting down closer and closer to the water. My plane was faster than his, so I kept gaining on him each time. I had hoped the other F-6F would move in and hit the Tony, but soon he was gone. Now, we had dropped down to about 100 feet of altitude and were flying over the rice paddies just west of Manila City. The Tony pulled another very tight turn into me and broke loose enough to come back at me head-on. His four guns were flashing at me, while my six guns were putting out the tumbling lines of corkscrewing bullets going harmlessly toward him. Maybe they looked dangerous to him, but I knew better. Again, I'm thinking about what that felt like for you. You got a plane flying straight at you, and his guns work fine, and all his bullets are heading at your plane, and you're pretty much defenseless. That's got to be a horrible feeling.
Yes, it's a very, very unsettling feeling, but it only happens for a short instance. It doesn't go on very long.
And you wrote in your book here that this Japanese pilot in that Tony was an excellent pilot. The time that you were over there, the missions you flew, was that typical? Were you often up against pilots you could tell were experienced, or were there times where those pilots weren't quite as sharp as you were?
They were always sharp. They were good pilots, very good pilots. They flew very good airplanes. They were a tough crowd to fight against.
And you described in this narrative that your mistake was getting so upset and offended by him busting through that you chased after him. But it sounds like in the comment you just made that you carry a lot of respect for the pilots that you were flying against.
Lots of respect. They were brave men and put up a good fight and took everything we could do to go up against them.
All right, well, that story wasn't done, so I'm going to keep reading. Again, these are all your words. We passed each other nearly head-on with about 20 feet between our two right wingtips, and as I looked across, I could see the helmeted face in his cockpit looking back at me. This is the only time during the war that I actually saw the face of the human I was fighting rather than just an airplane. That sounds like that made an impression on you.
Yes, it made an impression. It's still there. The image is still there, yeah. I don't think it changed anything. They were our targets, and we were out there to shoot them down.
Well, you continue. By this time, I knew the whole effort was hopeless. I would never shoot down this Tony with these burned-out guns, and if we repeated this routine enough times, he might very well get me. So after our head-on pass, I continued flying to the east and watched him in my rearview mirror as he flew to the west, leaving a thin trail of smoke behind him. He wanted to go home, and I decided to let him. I flew across Manila Bay, which was littered with the smoking remains of enemy ships. The late afternoon sky was empty of planes except for mine, and I flew across Luzon and then about 200 miles out into the Philippine Sea to find the Wasp. I must confess at this point that what I did that afternoon was not very smart, and also I ignored the flight tactics and doctrine that had been so thoroughly drilled into us. Fighter pilots were not supposed to go chasing off alone on personal missions. The fighter pilot's primary job and responsibility was to protect our bombers, and I had been wrong to let myself be sucked out of position and away from our group of planes. Also, it was just dumb luck that saved me from another Japanese plane picking me off while I was concentrating on that one Tony. So that's what you wrote in this book published in 2001. But my question is, did you understand that right away? Those lessons that you reflect on here and say, that was not the way to do it, did that have an impact right there in that moment that changed how you flew after that?
Yes, it had an initial impact, but it took a little while for it to all sink in and for me to gradually wise up and become a little smarter pilot.
And I've got to ask you this one too. And everybody's got a little different view on it. And I respect yours, whatever yours is. So you say it was just dumb luck that saved me from another Japanese plane picking me off while I was concentrating on that one Tony. And I know that was not your only close call. We could probably sit here all day talking about the things that could have killed you in World War II. So was it all just luck that you came back here to Fresno to raise four kids, to create all these sculptures and woodworking? Or as you contemplate, as you took all the time to write this book, do you feel that someone was pulling some strings or someone was protecting you? How do you really feel about it?
Well, naturally, I felt I was the world's greatest fighter pilot. That's taken for granted. But I knew that there was an awful lot of luck, that someone was riding along with me and protecting me. I was a very lucky pilot. In the heat of combat, you're just thinking about what you're doing right then, not thinking about tomorrow or anything else along the side. There was an aspiring to stay alive and to get to the next battle, but no great desire to be an ace or anything like that. I was one of the youngest pilots in the Navy. Nearly all the other guys in my squadron were several years older than I was. There was one other pilot in the squadron, Skip Corey, and he was the youngest pilot in the Navy, and he was a few days younger than I was.
And there's a story in your book where you and another pilot, Joe Doherty, because you're both younger and single, conspire to take the two planes available that day and keep your friend Don Gruber from flying because he was married and had a newborn. It describes how the two of you even rigged a coin flip to ensure Gruber wouldn't fly that day. That happened July 4th, 1944, and on the 75th anniversary here a couple months ago, you received a note from Gruber's family thanking you, because the reality is he would have been killed. He would have been flying the plane Doherty flew and been in the same spot. Doherty, of course, did not come back from that mission. You did, and you said earlier that this happened enough that you almost got used to it and you managed those emotions. But I see the emotion and gratitude from the Gruber family that you and Joe were willing really to trade your lives for his. So I read about Doherty's death or your roommate Al Lorraine who didn't come back from another one of your missions. And what I wonder is, over all this time, and it took hours and hours and really years of your life to put this book together, did you ever find yourself imagining about Al, Joe, whomever, here's the kind of life he would have led if he had made it home safely?
Oh, yes, there's always that thought. Wonderful young men, their lives were cut short while they were still young men. I look back with great fondness on those good friends.
And there is another story along those lines that we're going to talk about when we come back. A lifelong friend, a former college football teammate who would be awarded the Navy Cross and the Silver Star for a heroic decision that would cost him his life. We'll hear about it from 96-year-old Chuck Houston when we come back. I know I've said it a time or two, and you're hearing it for yourself when I read some of these passages, but this book is amazing. Flying with Iron Angels. And that name, Iron Angels, there's a story there. There's an insignia there. And it has Chuck Houston's name all over it. We'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.